You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America, and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul, 13 Lectures, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 24th of June, 1921. Following the historical considerations that we have taken into account, we shall devote our attention today to the human being of the present time, which will then give us the opportunity to look more closely over the next few days at how we are situated in time as a whole. We must be clear that the person before us as a being of spirit, soul, and body is integrated into the world in three different ways. That is already obvious when, let's say, we look at a person purely from the outside. From the perspective of the spirit, the person can move about independently of outer phenomena. From the perspective of the soul, one is not so independent. We need only look at certain connections which are evident in the course of life, and it will become apparent how what belongs primarily to our soul life is also connected with the outer world. One can be downcast or cheerful. Try to remember how you may often have felt oppressed in a dream, and have found on awakening that this is related to an irregularity in the rhythm of your breathing. One might object that this is a crude observation, but there is nevertheless always a similar connection between the rhythms at work in our breathing, our blood circulation, and the outer rhythms and the outer rhythmic life of the whole cosmos. All that goes on in our souls is connected with the rhythm of the world. Thus, while on the one hand, as spiritual beings, we feel to a large extent independent of our surroundings, we cannot feel the same in respect of our soul life, for that is always embedded within the general rhythm of the world. We are even more embedded in the phenomena of the world as physical beings. To begin with, we can start from basic phenomena. As a physical body, one is heavy. One has a certain weight. Other purely mineral objects also have their weight. Minerals, plants, animals, and also humans, to the extent that we are physical beings, are all subject to general gravity. And in a certain sense, we all have to lift ourselves out of this general gravity if we wish to make our body the physical instrument of our spiritual life. We have often mentioned that if it were purely a matter of the physical weight of our brain, it would be so big, 1,200 to 1,500 grams, that it would flatten all the veins beneath it. But this brain is subject to the Archimedean principle in the sense that it is floating in cerebral fluid. So much of its weight is lost by virtue of it floating in cerebral fluid, that it in fact only weighs 20 grams, and so only presses down on the veins in the cranial cavity with 20 grams weight. You can see from this that our brain is reaching up far more than pressing down. It resists gravity. It tears itself free from the general gravitational force. In doing so, however, it is no different from any other body you might place in water, and which loses as much of its weight as that of the water it displaces. This is one example of the whole interplay between our physical body and the outer world. Moreover, in this case, we are not incorporated in a rhythm, as we are with the weaving of our soul life, but instead are standing fully within this outer physical life. Whenever we are standing in a particular place on the earth, we are pressing down on that place. When we go to another place, we press down on that. Thus, with our physical bodies, we are no different from physical beings in the other kingdoms of nature. To summarize, in our spiritual nature, we are in a certain sense independent of our surroundings. In our soul nature, we are incorporated in the rhythm of the world. and in our physical nature we are incorporated into the whole surrounding world as if we did not also have a soul or a spirit. We have to make this distinction. We will be unable to understand our higher being unless we take account of this threefold orientation of our body toward all that surrounds us. Let's now look at these surroundings. Initially, we have what is determined by the laws of nature. Here I am summarizing various things that we have looked at over the last few months, only from different points of view. Imagine the universe governed by the laws of nature, the whole visible or otherwise sense-perceptible world harnessed by the laws of nature. Let's first take a look at this aspect of our surroundings. A simple reflection will tell us that we are now dealing with a purely earthly world. Only thoughtless and unfounded hypotheses by physicists could suggest that the laws of nature, which we observe around us here on Earth, would also apply in the cosmos beyond us. I have often mentioned to you how surprised physicists would be if they could reach up to the place where the sun is. Physicists, after all, view the sun as something like a big gas oven, albeit without walls, roughly speaking, as burning gas. They would not find this burning gas if they reached the place in the cosmos where the sun is. They would find something very unlike what they imagined. If this, and there's a drawing, encompassed the space we imagine to be taken up by the sun, we would find not only none of the materials that are present on the earth, but not even what we call empty space. Start by imagining the space filled. After all, as we live here on earth, we are always surrounded by space that is filled. If it is not filled with dense or fluid substances, then it will at least be filled with air, or warmth, or light, and so forth. In short, we are always dealing with space that is filled. But you also know that one can create an empty space, at least approximately, by pumping the air out of a cylinder with an air pump. Now, imagine any given filled space. We will give it the letter A, with a plus sign in front of it, plus A. Now, we can empty the space more and more, and the space A will become smaller and smaller, but the space is filled, and so we will keep the plus sign in front of it. Although in reality it is not possible in our conditions here on Earth because we can only approximately empty the space, we can nevertheless imagine that it would be possible to completely empty an airtight space. Then, in the part of the space that has been emptied, there will remain only space. I shall give it the symbol O. It has zero content. In principle, we can do the same with this space as you can with your purse. When your purse is full, you can take more and more out of it. Finally, there will be nothing left in it, zero. If you want to continue to spend money, you can no longer take money out of the purse because there is nothing in it, but you can run up a debt. Thus you can imagine both the space and the purse as being not only empty, but, as it were, sucking, with less than nothing left in it. Minus A. We now have to think of the sun as occupying the space of the sucking chamber, which is not only empty, but has a content which is the opposite of being filled with matter. So the sun is sucking in, rather than pressing out as it would be if it were gas. It is filled with negative materiality. I only wish to bring this as an example, so that you can see that one cannot simply transfer earthly laws into extraterrestrial conditions in the cosmos. We have to think of these as quite different from what we are familiar with in our surroundings on Earth. Thus, when we are speaking of certain laws at work, we have to say, there are laws at work within our earthly surroundings, including the world of matter, which is immediately accessible to us. Now imagine this world of our earthly existence. You need only observe the processes that are going on in the mineral world, and what you have initially, to the extent that you can see it, is completely subject to the laws of earthly existence. We could say that the mineral world is an enclosed system. However, something else is also enclosed. when we walk around or are carried around, if I may put it so crudely, when we only behave like objects in this physical world, we are subject to the same system of laws. In terms of earthly laws, it makes no difference whether a cobble is being carried around or a human being. In terms of the laws governing the earth, there is no difference. You have only to think it through. In terms of earthly laws, what matters is only our change of place, which we could also, of course, bring about ourselves. That is connected with other things. But if we are only studying earthly laws, it doesn't matter what is going on inside the skin of a person or what is going on in the person's soul. All that matters is the change of place in earthly space. The second point, then, apart from the mineral world, is the moving human being, moving as seen from the outside. See table on page 45. We can see no other relationship to this outer world to the human being, insofar as it is earthly and perceptible to our senses, than that it is concerned with the externally moving person. If we want to see the human being from a different perspective, we shall have to look elsewhere. That is when we come to our extraterrestrial surroundings. And if, for example, we are studying the environment of the moon, we would be looking at what emanates from the moon. Something of the effect of the moon on the earth can still be detected. At least many people think so. It is widely held that there are such influences of the moon on the earth, for example, in the case of the link between the movements of the moon and rainfall. Educated people today consider that to be a superstition. Now, I have told at least some of you about a charming event that took place in Leipzig. The interesting natural philosopher and aesthete, Gustav Theodor Fechner, went so far as to write a book about the effect of the moon on weather conditions. He was a university colleague of the well-known botanist and researcher Schleiden. Schleiden, of course, as a modern materialist, was deeply convinced that any idea such as his colleague was promulgating about the influence of the phases of the moon on weather conditions must be based on superstition. Now it happened that, as well as the two learned men, their two wives were also in Leipzig. And in those days, conditions there were so simple that people collected rainwater for their washing. The women maintained that in certain phases of the moon, one could collect more rainwater for washing than in others. Moreover, Frau Professor Fechner said that she believed what her husband had published about the influence on the moon's phases on weather conditions. For that reason, she wanted to reach an agreement with Frau Professor Schleiden, who did not believe this, that the latter would put out her rainwater barrel according to Professor Schleiden's directions. She would then certainly collect just as much water as Professor Fechner's wife would collect on the good advice of her husband. Sure enough, although Professor Schleiden regarded Professor Fechner's view as extremely superstitious, Frau Professor Schleiden refused to do this deal and wanted to put out her barrels at the same time as Frau Professor Fechner. Well, now, our modern scientific consciousness is at present less able to see the influence of the forces exerted by other planetary bodies. But if, for example, we were to focus our attention more exactly on the line taken by the leaves on the stem of a plant, as will be done in our Institute for Science and Physiology in Stuttgart, then we would see how every single line is linked with the movements of the planets, how these lines are somehow miniature images of the planetary movements. And we would find that there are a number of things on the Earth's surface which can only be understood when one is familiar with extraterrestrial phenomena and does not simply identify them with terrestrial ones. In other words, when one starts from the premise that laws apply in the cosmos that are not telluric. So we can say that there is a second system of laws that work within the cosmos, and only once we begin to study these cosmic influences, it will be quite possible to do so empirically, will we have a genuine science of botany. Our world of plants growing on the earth does not grow out of the earth in the way that materialistic botany imagines. but is drawn up out of the earth by cosmic forces. And the plant growth, drawn out by the cosmic forces, is infused with mineral forces, which in a way infuse the plant's cosmic skeleton, so that it can be perceived by our senses. So we can say, firstly, that the world of plants is encompassed by the working of these cosmic laws, and secondly, that everything that is involved with our inner movement, certainly physical, but inner movement, is likewise governed by these cosmic laws. This is, admittedly, not so easy to observe as it is in the plant world, because these movements have acquired a certain independence and do not rely on the rhythms of outer processes to the same extent, but inwardly imitate them. In the first place, earthly laws encompass our outer movements. But if we turn our attention to our digestion, to the movement of nutrients in our digestive organs, and go on to look at the flow of blood through our blood vessels, there is a great deal more that moves within us. We will have an image of what is moving in us, regardless of whether we are walking or standing still. This cannot be so easily integrated into the first system of laws, but it has to be integrated within cosmic rules, just like the forms and movements of the plants. The only difference is that with human beings this process takes place more slowly. So we can say, secondly, the movements that take place within the human being are included there. So, you can imagine the cosmos somehow exerting its influence from indeterminate distances down into the life that is unfolding on the surface of the earth. However, if there were only these two sets of laws that work in the way I have just suggested, then nothing but the mineral world and the plant world could be present on the earth. We ourselves could not be there. If human beings were there, they would be able to move and inner movements could happen, but of course it takes more than that for a human being to be present. Animals would likewise be excluded. In practice, only minerals and plants could exist on earth. For animals and humans to be present, cosmic laws and cosmic content would have to be imbued and interwoven with something which we can no longer attribute to space, where space is no longer something we can refer to. Naturally, everything that belongs in categories 1 and 2 can be thought of as belonging to space. But now we have to conceive of something where there is no space, but which is nevertheless subject to all the laws of the cosmos. You have only to think of how all our movements, our inner movements, are linked to the rhythms at work in us. Initially, we can think of the nutrients within us moving about in the blood circulation. But our blood circulation is not just the coursing of nutritious fluid through our veins. The movement of our blood is rhythmical. And what is more, this rhythm has a particular relationship with the rhythm of our breathing, in which oxygen is consumed for our blood formation. We have this dual rhythm within us. I have pointed out how there is an inner law in the 4-to-1 relationship between our breathing rhythm and our pulse that is also the inner soul foundation for the rhythms of meter and verse. Thus there is a relationship between the movement that goes on inside us and rhythm. We went on to say that rhythm also has a relationship with our soul life. Similarly, we must find the relationship between what we observe in the movements of the stars and the cosmic soul, so that as a third point we can refer to the laws at work in the cosmic soul. See table on page 45. This will include, firstly, the animal kingdom, and secondly, all the rhythmical movements that take place in our physical human nature. These rhythms are connected to all the rhythms in the cosmos as a whole. We have mentioned this before, but we'll consider it further in the coming days. you will be aware that we take roughly 18 breaths per minute. If you multiply that by 60, you get the number of breaths taken per hour. Multiply that by 24, and you will have the total number of breaths taken in a day. The normal person will take roughly 25,920 breaths during the course of a day. This number of breaths is our daily rhythm, day and night. We know that the vernal equinox moves a little every year. One could say that the sun moves its spring rising point forward in the vault of the heavens. The time it takes for the vernal equinox to move through the 12 signs of the zodiac is 25,920 years. We can take that as the rhythm of our cosmos, and the rhythm of our breathing over a 24-hour period is a miniature image of it. Our own rhythm is woven into the rhythm of the cosmos through our souls, and thus into the laws of the cosmic soul. The fourth point that we can take into consideration is the system of laws governing the whole cosmos. As in all three previous sets of laws, this is a law within which we feel ourselves embedded when we become aware of ourselves as spiritual beings. To begin with, we cannot understand this or that about the world, since there is very little that can be understood with our present-day intellectuality, which is the commonly accepted approach to thought. So, with our spirit in this particular phase of human development, there is little that we are able to understand to begin with. However, once we do become aware of ourselves as spiritual beings, it is in the nature of how the spirit sees its own role to say to itself, "If I develop myself, no limits can be set to my understanding." The human spirit has by its nature to develop into the cosmos in thinking, feeling, and willing. And so because we bear our spirit within us, we have to relate to a fourth law, which is at work within the cosmic spirit, see table below. Only now do we come to what this means in terms of real being. For of course we ourselves could not be present at all in the other sets of laws. Only now do we find our own essence. But in particular, the aspect of ourselves which resides in the nerve sense system, all that is basically the bearer of our spiritual life, the processes at work in our nerves and our senses. When considering the human being, we first of all look at ourselves as a whole, with our head as the principal bearer of our nerve sense system, and then at the head itself. We are human beings who could say by virtue of our heads, and our most common, our most recognizably human feature is our head. There's a chart here. Number one, the laws at work within earthly existence, including, number one, the mineral world, number two, the human being brought into motion from outside. Part two, the laws at work within cosmic existence, including, number one, the plant world, number two, what is moving within us. Part three, the laws at work within the cosmic soul, including, number one, the animal kingdom, number two, rhythmic processes. Part four, the laws at work within the cosmic spirit, including number one, the human being, number two, nerve sense processes. We thus have two approaches to our own nature as human beings. If we take this as a summary of what we have been considering in the last few weeks, we are left with an image of our connection with our surroundings, but our surroundings extending beyond the purely spatial, since only items 1 and 2 in the table refer to the world of space. Items 3 and 4 refer to what is non-spatial. It is particularly difficult for people of the present day to think of anything not being in space, or to recognize that it makes no sense to talk of space when we are dealing with realities. Without doing that, however, we can't raise ourselves to the level of a science that takes account of the spirit. Anyone who wants to remain in the world of space will be unable to raise their awareness toward spiritual entities. The last time I was here, I spoke to you about the worldview of the Greeks in order to demonstrate that people saw things differently in other times. The image that I have just presented to you is what can be understood by a person of the present day. All that is required is an unprejudiced attitude to the world, unhindered by the rubbish produced by today's science. I must now add something to what I told you about the Greek view of the world, so that we can find a connection to what I meant by this table. If someone today is well educated, he will see the world of space consists of roughly 70 elements which have different atomic weights and so on. These elements combine, and one can analyze them. What goes on in the world is based on chemical combinations and chemical releases among these 70-odd elements. At the moment, we will be less concerned with ways in which they can be traced back to something more fundamental. If an ancient Greek were to drop into our times, not someone in their current incarnation, who would then naturally think like our contemporaries, if he were well educated, he would say, quote, "These 70-odd elements are all very well, but they will not get you very far, since they do not really tell you anything about the world as a whole. We thought about the world in very different terms. We thought of the world as made up of fire, air, water, and earth." Close quote. The present-day person would reply, quote, "That is a childlike way of thinking. We progressed beyond that a long time ago. We consider them to be aggregate states of matter. The aeriform we would consider a gaseous aggregate state, the watery a liquid aggregate state of matter, and the earthly a solid aggregate state of matter. But warmth no longer has any validity for us in the terms you are speaking of. We have simply progressed beyond these childlike concepts. What constitutes the world for us is contained within our 70-odd elements." Close quote. The Greek would then reply, quote, "That is fine, but fire or warmth, air, water, and earth are quite different in our view from what you consider them to be. You have no understanding at all of what this meant to us." Close quote. The educated person of our time would at first be strangely affected by this reply, and would think that he was talking with someone from a more childlike level of cultural development. The Greek, however, who would at once see what was passing through the mind of the modern educated person, would certainly not hold back, but would go on, quote, "Yes, you see, what you call your 72 elements all belong to what we think of as the earth. It is fine that you differentiate, that you specify in more detail, but the qualities that you recognize in your 72 elements all belong to the earth as far as we are concerned. You have no understanding of water, air, or fire. You know nothing about them." Close quote. The Greek would go on, you see, I have not chosen a remote cultural epoch in the Far East, but a knowledgeable Greek. Quote, "What you say about your 72 elements with their syntheses and analyses is all very well, but what do you imagine they relate to? They all relate to us physical human beings once we are dead and buried. That is where our material substances, our whole physical body, would undergo the processes you would learn about in your physics and chemistry. What you can learn about the structural relationships within your 72-odd elements has no connection with our nature as living human beings. You know nothing about living human beings because you know nothing about water, air, and fire. Only when you know something about these can you understand anything about us as living human beings. What you can comprehend with your chemistry only tells you about what happens to a person who is dead and buried, about the processes that a corpse goes through. That is all you will find out about with your 70-odd elements." Close quote. Well, this would not get him very far with the modern educated person. But the Greek would perhaps try to explain a little further as follows. He would say, quote, look, what you consider your 72 elements, we consider as belonging entirely to the earth. It's true we look at things in general terms, but when you go into the specifics, it is only a more exact form of knowing, and this exact form of knowing will not let you reach any depth of understanding. If, on the other hand, you know what it is that we call water, you would have an element which is no longer governed purely by earthly conditions, but which, the moment it comes to expression in its weaving and living nature, is subject in its whole activity to the conditions prevailing in the cosmos. Close quote. What the Greek meant by water was not physical water, but rather all the forming principles that play into the earth from the cosmos, which include the movements found in water. The plant world is also included in these movements. It is in its nature to do so. Distinguishing it from all that belongs to the earthly element, the Greek saw the living and weaving characteristics of the element of water, and within these, the principles of vegetable life that are bound up with it. If we drew a diagram, we could place this watery element anywhere on earth and in any way, but always determined by the cosmos. Then we could imagine the mineral element sprouting up from below upward in all kinds of ways, the purely earthly element which then infuses the plants, as if injecting the plants with the earthly element. Now the Greeks' conception of the watery element was of something substantially new, which he saw in a very positive light. He did not think of it in terms of concepts, but in images and in imaginations. We would have to go back in time to Plato, since this way of seeing the world was destroyed by Aristotle, back to pre-Platonic times, and would then find out how the truly knowing Greek would use his faculty of imagination to see what lived in the watery element and what actually sustained vegetation whilst being closely related to the cosmos. Then he would go on to say, quote, you see, what is left lying in the grave when a person dies, and which is governed by the laws of your 70-odd elements, is bound up with the life of the etheric life streaming toward us from the cosmos, between birth or conception, let's say, and death. That is what one is imbued with as a living human being, and that is what you have no idea of, unless you think of water as a special element, and unless you see the plant world as bound up with this watery element, and can see these images as imaginations. Close quote. We Greeks, he would say, quote, did indeed speak of a human etheric body, but this was not something we made up. We described it as follows. What appears before our inner eyes when we see the world of plants sprouting and greening around us in the spring, when we see how this gradually takes on all kinds of colors, then how it bears fruit in the summer and the leaves wither in the autumn, what can appear to us when we follow the course of the year in the vegetation around us, and when we have an inner understanding of it, we can relate to in the same way in which we relate to the mineral world when we eat our bread and meat. Just as we relate to the mineral world through our bread and meat, we can relate to what we can see in the world of plants in the course of the year. If we now immerse ourselves in the view of the world that sees everything that takes place within us in the 24-hour day as a miniature image which then repeats itself throughout our whole lives, we can see that we contain within us a miniature image of what is going on out there in the watery, etheric element, and which constitutes our surroundings from out of the cosmos. If we can understand the outer world in this way, we can then say what is outside there lives within us. Just as we say, the spinach is growing out there. I'll pick it, eat it, and then have it in my stomach, that is, in my physical body. We can also say, the cycle of the year in my surroundings lives and weaves as an etheric life, and I have this within me too. Close quote. It was not physical water the Greek was thinking of. What he grasped in these imaginations, and related to the human being in such a living way, was fundamental to his view of the world. Then he would go on to say to his speaking partner, quote, "You are studying the corpse, lying in the grave, because you only study the earth, and your 70-odd elements are themselves earth. We studied the living human being. In our time, we also studied the person who has not yet died, but who grows and moves out of inner activity. We cannot do this unless we raise our consciousness to the other elements." Close quote. That is how it was for the ancient Greeks, and if we went further back, the elements of air and fire or warmth would also appear before us in full clarity. We shall later investigate this too. But today I wish first of all to point out how the fact that we cannot see the right interrelationship of forces within us is because we cannot work out how these forces interrelate in the world outside, because we choose to ignore them. This is characteristic of our cultural development since the first third of the 15th century. The fact that we have simply lost our understanding for the interrelationship of the elements and with it our capacity for understanding the living human being. The science we recognize studies what is dead. Now, we have often heard that this phase in the history of human development had to come about and had to do so for other reasons, namely to enable humanity to go through the phase of developing the capacity for freedom. But a certain capacity for understanding our relationship with nature has been lost to us since the first third of the 15th century. Since then, our understanding has been focused entirely on this one element, the earth. We must now find our way back. We must find our way back to understanding the element of water through the power of imagination, the element of air through inspiration, and the element of fire through intuition. Fundamentally, our progress to higher knowledge from our customary concrete way of thinking through imagination, inspiration, and intuition is a progression through the elements. We will speak more about this the day after tomorrow, the end of Lecture 3.